Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. Those boys.
That's. Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I want to walk up.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I'm like to stay alive for 6 days. I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swampfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Well, there I was last night watching Kevin De Bruyne get not one, but two goals into Match of the Day's Goal of the Season nominations. And I was thinking, remind me again how Jordan Henderson won the Footballer of the Year award. Meanwhile, over in Fairview, a certain flame-haired flamethrower of bile was watching the same coverage, no doubt, thinking, remind me again how anybody thinks David Silva is Manchester City's greatest ever player. Welcome to Monday's Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hi, Murph.
Hey, Owen, how are you?
Ken, you were away last week. Straight back in with a knife in my heart. You know, you could have just WhatsApped me. You didn't need to write the thoughts down. You know, I wake up first thing on a Monday and read your column in the Irish Times. An esteemed publication. I mean, it's just to make a personal point towards me. Okay, here was the headline. Ken Early, David Silva is a Premier League great in pundits' dreams. Subheadline, it's patently absurd to rank the Spanish player among the best the league has seen. Now, oftentimes you have disputed. I shouldn't say oftentimes, the good people putting those subheadings in place. Sometimes you feel it doesn't always reflect what's in the column. Is that headline and subheadline a fair summation of your thoughts at the end of a what's been a glorious era for the David Luiz decade, or the David, Freudian slip, the David Silva decade in the Premier League?
You get into this sort of realm of semantics where a Premier League great, no, I'm sorry, that's not what was being said. What's being said is he the best ever Premier League player, or the best foreign player, or the best creative midfielder? That was what Thierry Henry, teammate of Robert Pires, said about David Silva. Or is he just the best?
The greatest of all time.
The greatest of all time since 1992. people like Graham Souness, Alan Shearer have suggested this. I quoted their relevant comments in the piece. Now, obviously, everybody has to come up with things to say. It will be interesting at some point to just see how many players have been referred to as the greatest in the history of the Premier League by all of these pundits. I'm pretty sure it's not just one player in each case. That's the nature of talking about this great game. It's just that I can't understand how anyone would ever talk about this guy as being the greatest player. He's never even been the best player of Man City. I'm repeating myself. We've been through this, but you did mention Jordan Henderson. He won the Footballer of the Year, the Football Writers Footballer of the Year last week, as you mentioned. And of course, maybe it seems like a bit of a travesty that David Silva famously never won this award or the PFA Player of the Year award, and in fact only once the Manchester City Player of the Year award.
I know you're going to tell me that's three times fewer than Richard Dunn, but anyway, off you go.
Four time champion Richard Dunn. David Silva has as many Man City Player of the Year awards as Stephen Ireland, right? So that's a fact, right? Kevin De Bruyne has been there half the time; he's got twice as many awards. I would submit to you, Owen, that Kevin De Bruyne's performance yesterday was better than anything David Silva has served up in 10 years.
I actually thought you were going to make the point that Kevin De Bruyne was silently subtweeting everyone saying all of the eulogies that he knew were coming David Silva's way. And I was just like, maybe I should just remind people by, first of all, equaling Thierry Henry. By the way, like, the idea that you could talk about David Silva as being on the same planet as Thierry Henry, literally in this game, this beautiful send-off for David Silva, commentators are being forced to recognise the fact that Thierry Henry holds, until yesterday by himself, the record for the most Premier League assists, as well as being, like, an unbelievable goal scorer for the entire time that he was at Arsenal. And then... And the idea that people would be talking about Henri and David Silva in the same breath is just so outrageous.
Well, Roy Keane was doing it yesterday on Sky. He had the obligatory mention of Silva in the same breath as Henri and Shearer. So how would you sum him up as a player then, Roy?
Little genius. And I look at players who've played over the last 10 years, and I always think when I retired, players I would have loved to play against. But he's one I'm glad I never was around to play against, because I know he would have twisted me inside out. An absolute little genius.
Thanks to Tommy Toohey for the heads up on that. Little genius. Twice he calls him a little genius. Sorry, Murph, I interrupted your flow there.
Just basically the point was that, as Ken is saying, Kevin De Bruyne, like, sets the Premier League record for assists and scores two outrageously brilliant goals in this game. Just, I think, as a silent reminder to people that this is what an amazing, like, Premier League great looks like. And this guy, this formerly bald, now magnificently maimed, midfielder, while a very good player, a very, very good player, an excellent player.
What Brendan Rodgers would call a technician.
Yeah.
A superb technician.
Yeah, like, he's a really, really good footballer. But
it's so sad. You can't just be the bigger man here and, you know,
we're not being let on by all of these people talking David Silva up way beyond his abilities as a footballer. It's not David Silva's fault that these people go and say daft things like this.
Yeah,
it's not his fault.
Noel Gallagher is a football pundit. You know, he's a Man City fan.
He has been a pundit though. He has been on Sky.
Yep,
he's been on Match of the Day as well, hasn't he? He said he's won one award in 10 years. Now, I don't know what award he's referring to. I assume it's the Manchester City Player of the Year award. He may incorrectly believe that David Silva's won one of the Player of the Year awards in England, which he hasn't, just to reiterate. I think he won Player of the Month once. Now, that is correct. He did win one Player of the Month award. He's been in the team of the season twice or something. Yes, that's correct. He's been in the team of the season two times. You know, he's no Jordan Henderson, says Gallagher. And he then says, I think he was so sublime that you almost didn't notice that he was playing. That's the problem. He's actually too good that he becomes invisible and nobody can tell that he's out on the field. He's so amazing that he simply disappears from matches. That's what we're talking about.
Listen, I know you two boys. I know you two boys want to sit there. You want to watch Steven Gerrard whack in 30-yard screamers. That's something that you can wrap your little football brains around. But for those of us like today's guest, Jack Pitbrook, myself, Roy Keane, who else? Graeme Souness, basically every pundit. We see the intricacies. Noel Gallagher there. We understand that sometimes the great players are barely seen on a football pitch.
Good, yeah, that's good. I like the company you're keeping there on. Mm-hmm.
We have got more on this with Jack Pitbrook and Jacob Steinberg a little bit later on. Hell of a guest coming up for you on the World Service for World Service members tomorrow. I'm not sure how many of you have seen the Netflix documentary Athlete A that's been out since last month about the child sex abuse carried out by the former USA gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar. And the documentary is also about the many failures of authorities in protecting those children. Really excellent film. Murph and Malachy Clerkin featured it on the show a few weeks ago. One of the main contributors to it is Rachel Den Hollander. Now, she was the first person to go public with her account of being abused by Nassar, and she's been leading the fight for justice ever since. Here she is addressing the judge during her victim impact statement back in January 2018.
There are two major purposes in our criminal justice system, Your Honor. The pursuit of justice and the protection of the innocent. Neither of these purposes can be met if anything less than the maximum available sentence under the plea agreement is imposed upon Larry for his crimes. So I ask, how much priority should be placed on communicating that the fullest weight of the law will be used to protect another innocent child from the soul-shattering devastation that sexual assault brings. I submit to you that these children are worth everything, worth every protection the law can offer, worth the maximum sentence. Thank you.
That was Rachel Den Hollander speaking 2.5 years ago. But, you know, even though Nasser is in jail now for the rest of his life, it's pretty clear that not enough has been done to hold accountable all the other adults and the institutions who failed the young gymnast. It's something that Rachel is still striving to put right. And she's going to tell us all about that fight on the podcast tomorrow. So that's going to be a good one. To hear that interview, you can become a member of the Second Captains World Service on secondcaptains.com for £5 a month plus VAT. For the final time, Ken, this Premier League, this extremely long Premier League season, report on sport, please.
Just on that point then of you know, Henderson, like as Nogar said, he's now Jordan Henderson with, I think, a certain sardonic edge, would it be fair to say? I mean, I was, I have to admit, a little bit surprised. I mean, I wasn't that surprised that the Football Writers would give Jordan Henderson the award. I mean, it was obviously the wrong decision. You know, it's clearly wrong. He's not the best. He's not the Footballer of the Year.
Who is the Footballer of the Year?
He's not the Footballer of the Year at Liverpool. He's not the Footballer of the Year in the Premier League. But he's won the Footballer of the Year. Now, who is? I mean, if you're asking me who I think was the best player, I would go for Mane. I would say Mane was the best player. I'm going to let you finish, but I think Mane was the best player this year. Yeah, you know, I think he came through at sort of big moments. I think he was just, I mean, you could even look at Liverpool and say, well, you know, why say Mane? I mean, Salah scored more goals, you know, had more goal contributions or whatever. And that's true. I just think that he was there for them at really big moments. He made the difference in difficult situations, more so than Henderson, who I think, you know, had a really good wholehearted season. You know, I mean, why do they give him the award? I mean, partly I suppose it's England. It's about the culture of the game. You know, that's a guy like David Silva. He loves the small spaces. You know, like you couldn't get the ball off him in a phone box. Like, you know, that's what people say about him. It's an extraordinarily useless skill when you think about it. There are no phone boxes. What Jordan Henderson knows is that a football pitch is 7,140 square meters of open space to bound through forcefully, barking. You know, that's what football in England is about. Windy, open spaces, crashing into people. You know, you've got that. You've got that going for him. You know, partly I think it's interviews. You know, have you ever seen, I think, did Gallagher actually mention in his comments today that he didn't think Silva's ever done an interview? Mistake. You know.
But he did one last night. He was on Match of the Day. Softly spoken, you won't be surprised to hear. Very friendly, okay. Smiley
man. I mean, you know, but what's Mane going to say at the Football Writers do? You know what I mean? Like, he's not going to say much, is he? Like, whereas with Hendo, you get full commitment. You know that if you book Hendo, he's going to come along. He's going to be soulful. He's going to give a respectful speech. He's probably going to bring Adam Lallana. There's definitely going to be tears. There's 100%. It's going to be like, everyone's going to be crying. People are going to be like, oh no, you know, I vote for De Bruyne, but like, oh, that was beautiful. You know, people are going to be like texting under the table, you know, I love you, Mom, right? This is the kind of stuff that Hendo's going to do, right? If he gets there. And I can understand that there's, you know, that is an element of it. You know, there's this led by precept and example. But you know what I think the main reason is why Jordan Henderson's won this award and David Silva never has, despite, you know, even I'm going to say David Silva's a much better footballer than Jordan Henderson. Like, you know, he is as much, Hendo is as little on the level of David Silva as David Silva is on the level of some of the players he's said to be better than, like Cristiano Ronaldo or Luis Suarez. The main reason is that image of Jordan Henderson holding aloft the Champions League trophy and the Premier League trophy. These are the reasons why he's regarded as Footballer of the Year and David Silva never has. You know what I mean? If it's like, you know, Silva obviously has won the Premier League, but in each occasion, you know, someone in the City team, made was judged to have made more of a contribution. City don't do well at these awards. It is true. Like as Pep said that thing, oh, this award is always for Liverpool. Actually, Raheem Sterling had won it last season, as Pep had maybe forgotten. I don't know. But they've never won a PFA Player of the Year award, which is remarkable. You know, when you consider that City have been like the best team over the last, on average, the best team over the last decade, that they haven't won a PFA Player of the Year award is a real indictment of the players, I have to say. You know, at least that's one that you can't pin on the biased media or the narrative-obsessed media. I mean, Hendo is narrative. You know, Silva is just sort of technical ability. But, like, I feel if Silva had won the Champions League and was holding it aloft, then he might have been in with it. He might have been in with more of a shout. But, of course,
well,
he
certainly
never
if you're going for leader
one
of
chance,
the year. Yeah,
one or, to go.
You know, Jordan Henderson has definitely been the best leader this year. But is he a better footballer than, dare I say, David Silva? Is he a better footballer than Kevin De Bruyne? Even Trent Alexander-Arnold, you mentioned Mane, mentioned Salah. I mean, Alexander-Arnold's just an absolute phenomenon.
Phenomenal. Like, yeah.
You know, even the early fears about his defensive ability seem to have gone by the wayside. And he's added free kicks. He's an absolute joke. I'd probably pick him, actually, above all the other Liverpool players. But
you pick him above, But, you know,
it's a close
again, there's De Bruyne as well. Like, I think De Bruyne probably will win the PFA Player of the Year this year. I think he probably will.
What would you put that down to? The fact that their fellow players seem to dislike Manchester City players intensely.
Well, is it that they dislike them, or is it that is it the David Ginola effect? You know, when David Ginola won the award in 99?
Five? No?
No, he won it in 1999, which was the year that another team did something more memorable. What happened in 1999? I mean,
the football year, as told through its main protagonist, David Ginola.
Exactly. Now, it was said that perhaps there were simply too many outstanding Manchester United players that year. Perhaps when people had voted for Andy Cole and Dwight York and Roy Keane and David Beckham and Ryan Giggs and, yes, even Paul Scholes and certainly Jaap Stam and perhaps a few for big Peter Schmeichel. And don't forget Teddy Sheringham and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, that by the time that all these votes had been handed out, most of the votes had gone to these players, but there was only a small pile of votes at the feet of each of these worthy candidates. And there was a fractionally larger pile of votes madly placed at the feet of the false idol David Ginola. The clay feet of the false idol had a slightly larger sheaf of votes from, I don't know, Premier League players who support Tottenham or, I don't know, who hate Manchester United. One way or the other, he ended up nicking it ahead of them. But, you know, I don't even know, because, like, if you remember, Keane won the award the following year. Didn't Teddy Sheringham win it in 2001? You know, like, it wasn't as though Man United struggled to win the award in general just because they had, like, more than one good player. You know, so I really don't know. Some combination of these things. You know, maybe they just needed to be a little bit better. You know, if I think of who did win, like, who was it? Like, it's often some insane performance. Like, Bale won it a couple of years. Like, just nobody. He was untouchable. Like, nobody was close to him. You know, in 2011, 2013, Van Persie was sensational in 2012. Suarez in 2014. Salah, you know, broke the goal-scoring record. Like, De Bruyne was clearly going to win that. And then Salah, like, broke Ronaldo's record. And you're kind of, and they get to the Champions League final off the back of his goals. And you're like, well, actually, that is individually slightly better. You know, on each time, there's just been someone who's come along and done something incredible. Mahrez, rather, in 2016. We've talked enough about that.
Those are the individual awards again. Talk about the team awards every group of players grows up dreaming about. Third and fourth place in a league table.
Third and fourth place.
Trophy on.
Yeah, 17th and 18th, or 16th and 17th place, also important spots to take up.
But can I just mention quickly the Irish land speed record set by Aaron Connolly? but does he have to do, like, I mean, it's an amazing goal. You know, you see, well, you're like, wow, look at this guy go. And I'm like, who's the Burnley defender who he's destroying there? And I'm trying to, and I'm like, is that Tarkovsky? Everyone's going on about how great Tarkovsky is. Maybe he's destroyed Tarkovsky there. No, it's Kevin Long.
Oh,
it's Kevin. It's another Irishman being fed into the meat grinder of Aaron Connolly's rise to greatness. Do you have to cannibalize the careers of your fellow Irishmen in such a way? Look, it's great to see him back on the goal trail. Just pity the goal trail ends right now for a few weeks, but you know, resumes with international duty soon. And he's looking like he's in really good shape. So where are we? So we'll start with the third and fourth place. Now, obviously, this was coming into this. He had a couple of big clubs with big dreams, young managers with big big dreams. Frank Lampard, tough week for him. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, again, fraught under some pressure. But luckily for both of them, a fairy godmother in the form of Brendan Rodgers, who was able to make both their dreams come true by piloting Leicester City. Come on. You know, did you see Jonathan Wilson's piece on The Guardian the other day where he was sort of saying, look, are Leicester City the really exciting team that won like 12 out of 14 games, you know, beat Southampton 9-0 and so on and so forth? Or are they the team that has kind of completely blown it and bottled it since February and slid out of the reckoning and are nowhere? And the answer is that they're both of those teams. The truth, as Jose Mourinho would say, is in the hole. That's WH.
Gotcha.
So, you know, they are neither just one thing nor the other. They're both things. But I retort to Jonathan Wilson. I say they were one thing and then they became the other thing. I'm introducing a linear concept of time here where they were at one point this and then they sort of changed into this, and that's what they now are more closely than the thing that they were. You know what I mean? Like, if this was all happening in one eternal instant of time, then we could say, yes, they're the same. But I'm just I would be a little concerned if I was a Leicester City fan that the more recent manifestations of Leicester City are the ones which are kind of currently dominant and which will be sticking in the mind of people as they worriedly contemplate next season under Brendan Rodgers. Who says that he is excited about the forthcoming Europa League campaign? I'm really excited by that. It's that next step for this squad of players. The boys have had a good season. Those experiences of playing midweek will make us more robust. I'm excited for it. So it sounds as though actually everyone's dream came true, which we didn't think was possible. But Brendan Rodgers has made it happen. He complained a bit about the penalty that Manchester United were given. And in fairness, the penalty. Like, you will seldom see any player fall to the ground more gratefully than Anthony Martial. Like, you know, he's just like, you know, it's almost like when you kind of tuck your arms up to your chest and sort of fall sideways into a pool, you know, that kind of way. He's like, yep, that's a penalty. I'll take that one. And, but it is a penalty. It's like two penalties. You know, yeah. It's like both defenders are competing.
I thought one was debatable. If it was just the Evans one, it's one of those, oh, you know, did he get a nick on the ball? Was it from behind? You're debating it. But in the meantime, Wes Morgan has come and crashed through the back of him.
It was like a nailed on penalty. You know, you're watching it, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe what penalty they've just given away there. Like, did they have to do that? But look, I wouldn't have too much time for those complaints. The good news, or what did Rodgers basically said, we need to sign creative attacking players because, you know, that's... It was a bit, you know, he said, I knew we'd need 65 goals. We got 67, which is a pretty good total for Leicester. But in order, if they want to take the next step, then they need to add players. I mean, it's a decent goal-scoring record. I mean, they scored more than Manchester United, who have obviously the very vaunted forward line of, you know, the three lads and Bruno. Although Bruno Fernandes has only been there obviously since January, but it's still pretty good. And Leicester today, there's the Leicester Mercury reporting that James Maddison signed a new contract, which is, I guess, at least Leicester are protecting his transfer value. Although maybe a reflection of the fact that maybe the the man I've just mentioned, Bruno Fernandes, has kind of closed off the avenue that people maybe thought were opening up, was opening up for Maddison.
Maddison has been injured as well for most of the post-lockdown, certainly for most of July. What's the fullback called? I've forgotten his name. Pereira has been injured as well.
Chilwell.
Yeah, they've got.
And Soyuncu was out of this game because he kicked. I can't remember who it was, but he tried to kick a player into the air that time. Remember who scored the goal against them? Oh God! I mean, it only happened the other day. You remember they're all in net, and then he tries to kick opposition player out. They had had a very, was it Bournemouth? Yeah, it was Bournemouth.
Callum Wilson. It was Callum Wilson that he attempted to boot, wasn't it?
To boot. Could have been Wilson. Could have been Solanke. One of those Bournemouth nearly men. But look, yeah, so Maddison at least has signed up for more of this. Grealish, I don't know what his plan is. Apparently he was drinking shots with his mate Dean Smith till pretty late.
Well, at least Dean Smith is as good as his word then, because he was asked afterwards, what's in the future for Jack Grealish? And Dean Smith goes, he's coming out with me and he's getting drunk.
Well, this is apparently what happened. Maybe he made a drunken promise to stay at Aston Villa forever. I mean, he saved Villa, and then he nearly harpooned them back down into the Championship. Oh, man,
that last few minutes was just amazing. I'd been watching United-Leicester, I don't know if most people were. Then I started thinking, this isn't going anywhere. Once the first United goal went in, I'm kind of scratching around the relegation games thinking, well, this Watford comeback looks pretty exciting, but equally it's irrelevant unless they actually win the game, as long as Villa keep their point. So I watch Villa, even though it's a dull nil-all, and suddenly the first thing I see is Grealish nearly whipping one into the top corner after skipping inside a few players, then scoring his goal, then doing the, was it Paul Parker back in 1990? Lineker brought that one up, the West Germany goal, the semi-final that hit a defender, Parker, and looped over Shilton. So that happened with Brad Friedel in the, with Reina, I should say, in the Shilton position. And then there's just a few really anxious minutes, but then the celebration at the end when they realised that the Watford aren't going to come back. I thought it was great. I thought the Grealish stuff was brilliant.
Yeah, no, it was good. I mean, it was funny that bit at the end as well, because the thing is, Watford needed two goals, right? Watford needed to score two goals. So they kind of knew, but like you just saw the power of like sort of not wanting to tempt fate. You know, everyone's there. They all knew there's no way these guys are scoring two goals in like the next 50 seconds or whatever. Because Watford needed not only to draw but to win. So it was 3-2. But still, they kept their discipline. Nobody actually celebrated it until it was 100% confirmed. But where are we? Just getting back to the, you know, we don't want to just give all the credit to Brendan Rodgers for Frank Lampard and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer getting into the Champions League. I think I also deserve some credit.
I've been saying it for years, Ken. What are we giving you credit for again?
Well, I deserve some credit as one tiny sort of malignant part of the much greater festering entity that is the media surrounding football, because Ole Gunnar Solskjaer took the opportunity of finishing third in the league to, I wouldn't say round on his critics, but rather to look reproachfully at his critics and remind them that they haven't been right about everything. It didn't seem like you were expecting this, said Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed, says Daddy Solskjaer.
All the predictions were sixth or seventh. That's all right. If I'm getting criticized, that makes me stronger and makes me believe more in what I'm doing. Please don't praise me too much, because you can become complacent. That's just the way I'm made. I was reading through the predictions. Some of the staff were discussing them. To finish third with this team and this squad, which, by the way, has the second largest payroll in world football behind Barcelona, right? Behind only Barcelona. To finish third with this team and this squad and where we've been with this rebuild has been a massive achievement by everyone. We've come so far as a team. We're building a culture. To win this game was massive mentally after losing two semi-finals this season. Are you the right man to challenge Liverpool and Man City? Someone asked. I believe in what I do and what I've been doing. We all have different ideas of management. I do it my way. I'm not going to say I'm not the man, because I am in the job. That's a rousing call. But what was this he's saying about predictions? Well, it's interesting because, you know, thanks to the internet, these predictions aren't just a sort of a fever dream or like a kind of a, I think I remember they were all against me.
Tomorrow's fish and chip wrapper.
Yeah, no, it's you know, no. It's not just a bunch of last year's fish and chip wrappers. It's there as fresh as the day it was published on the internet. And we can see who said what about the predictions. And there was an interesting pattern when I started looking at these. Like the BBC's prediction, the BBC's thing, they've got like loads of pundits, you know, because the whole sort of BBC family, everyone who goes on Match of the Day or goes on BBC Radio or whatever, there's like a page of these guys. Every single one of them had Liverpool in the top four. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them had Man City in the top four. And every single one of them was right about that. But then we've got a pretty interesting thing begins to emerge here. Because there's another team that every single one of them, except for Karen Carney and Rude Hullett, also expect to be in the top four, who aren't in Spurs. The top four. Spurs?
Yeah.
Everybody thinks Tottenham are going to be third.
Was talking up Spurs at the start of the season. I remember it now. I'd forgotten that entirely until you. I saw where you were going with that, and I was thinking, yes, I remember people even saying Spurs were, you know, okay, they won't quite challenge Liverpool and City, but they'll be the ones thereabouts in behind them, you know.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? Like, you know, it just seems so long ago, like, or it's sort of like, wow, people thought Spurs were going to finish in the top four. You know, I probably thought Spurs were going to. I can't remember what my prediction was, but sadly, no one thought to write it down at the time.
It could be there. It could be there in podcast form if anyone is bored enough to listen back.
I'm sure it's there, and there will be at least one person bored enough to do it. Only one person of the BBC's panel got the top four actually correct. That was Rude Hullett. He was the only one who said Man City, Chelsea, Liverpool, Man United. Though he got the order wrong, but he got the four right. He's the only one out of them all. And there's like, oh, I don't know, 30 odd names here. But Tottenham, almost everybody, there's two exceptions, say they're going to have him in. Man United, well, obviously, you've got Danny Murphy, Alan Shearer, Rude Hullett, Karen Carney, Micah Richards, Lindsay Johnson, Kevin Kilbane. These guys all had Man United in the top four. They were correct. But as you can tell, that's not a majority. Most people didn't have Man United in the top four. So what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is saying, at least as far as the BBC have been concerned, is correct. They were not fancied. Who was more fancied, though, between Man United and Chelsea? Let me see. Chelsea. Rachel Brown-Finnis, Chris Waddle, Jolyon Lescott. Yeah, they all reckon Chelsea. Mark Schwarzer thinks Chelsea. Did he used to play for Chelsea, though? Rude Hullett thinks Chelsea, another former Chelsea man. Matthew Upson thinks Chelsea. So six. So actually, Man United were more fancied by this group of panel. This group of panelists. 1, 2, 3... 4, 5, 6, 7. Yes. So 7 went for Man United to be in the top four, and only 6 went for Chelsea. So Frank Lampard has actually exceeded expectations by like 1/30th more than Solskjaer. Do you see what I mean?
I do.
Do you respect my methods?
We acknowledge your methods.
So Frank Lampard was also on the same. I think coming into the job, not many people put us in that bracket. And to be fair, he is factually correct. I don't know if everybody does this now. If it's like a thing that you do, look at the pre-season predictions and see if you've managed to confound them. We know where we're at, and it's a process. Can we progress? Can we get better? Can we improve? Now that we've secured a top four finish, the question now is, can we close that gap? Now, obviously, Frank Lampard made this big call of dropping Kepa Arrizabalaga. He dumped the goalkeeper, who had conceded 5 in midweek. Now, you think back to those 5 goals Kepa let in, you're kind of scratching your head going, could he really? Was that really on Kepa? You know, you think Kate has won off the bar, Alexander-Arnold scored that free kick in the top corner, you know, the Firmino goal was fairly unstoppable, I think, with the cross that came in. What were the other goals? The Oxlade-Chamberlain one, maybe you could have saved it. Difficult to save that shot, though, realistically, the way it happens in the game. What was the other goal? Wijnaldum. Wijnaldum's one was kind of a snapshot into the top of the net. I don't know. I mean, there was one where Van Dijk should have scored, where Kepa didn't come for it. Maybe that was what he was thinking about, but I thought it was a bit like...
this wouldn't be very good in terms of a bargaining position, but was it Lampard alerting clubs to the fact that this guy might be available to purchase in the summer? Well, we're well into the summer now, but in the transfer window.
Well, certainly, I guess anyone who wants to sign Kepa probably knows they would be in with a chance that, you know, Frank might be willing to talk.
Just match that world record transfer fee and take his wages off our hands and we'll do a deal.
It's not the first, it's obviously not the first time that he's actually dropped him this season. But, you know, it is a bit of a problem. Like, Kepa is the most expensive goalkeeper in history, obviously. That doesn't mean he's the best paid goalkeeper in the world by any means. But it does mean that if Chelsea want to get rid of him, they're probably going to eat a bit of a loss on the transfer fee. They do have a problem with him, though, because when you look at what Chelsea have done this season, their expected goals differential, that is expected goals minus expected goals against for expected goals difference, is almost identical to Liverpool's. Almost identical to Liverpool's. Like, they're both around plus 28. I think Chelsea are plus 28.9 and Liverpool are plus 29.1. But the actual goal difference for Liverpool is not plus 29, it's plus 52. And the actual goal difference for Chelsea is not plus 28, it's plus 15. And the difference in Chelsea's case is mainly on the defensive side. Because while their expected goals for is 66 and their actual goals for is 69, so they've slightly outperformed it, they're only supposed to, according to the stats, have conceded 38 goals and they've let in 54. So that's a huge difference. With Liverpool, the difference is actually mainly on the attacking side. They've scored more goals than you would have expected them to. They've made, so of a difference in total of 23, I think 7 of them come from the defence and 16 come from the attack. I'm getting bogged down in these figures now, but the point is that Frank Lampard must be looking at that thinking, this is crazy. Like, we've had a much better season than it looks like on the table, and it's your fault. That's what Frank is going to be thinking every time he looks at Kepa. You know, people are laughing at me. And you heard people laughing at Frank Lampard at Anfield. You heard him losing his rag and people laughing. And he doesn't like being laughed at. I mean, nobody likes being laughed at, but I think Frank Lampard particularly doesn't like being laughed at.
And he took all that Leeds derby stuff in good good spirit last year.
Giving it the big one, Lampard. And immediately the internet is full of Lampard celebrating in the derby dressing room, singing Stop Crying Frank Lampard after winning the playoff semi-final. Amazing.
That was just unbelievable.
But still, when you look at the question is this, you're thinking this is Kepa's fault. And Kepa's save percentage is 54%, which is dire. But Kepa last season had between 67 and 68%. So it's like he's got much worse all of a sudden. Mm. Well, you know, players don't just suddenly get worse, do they? Like, not really. Not at his stage of the career. Like, you know, there's some explanation there, which Lampard maybe could try to unpick. But can he afford to wait around? The Lampard train is leaving the station here. You know, Timo Werner's aboard. Hakim Ziyech is aboard. Kai Havertz, we hear, is going to be aboard. Is Kepa going to be aboard? Is he going to board this train?
Is that the way Lampard is selling it to him? I mean, it would be irresistible, I'm sure, if he sold it.
The Frank Lampard Express is leaving the station.
He's going to do sound effects.
Are you going to fumble vainly with the automated ticket vendor in the station, or are you going to get aboard?
So
question.
It is a moment of awesome vindication for Frank Lampard. Of course, it's not the end of the season. Next week, there's the showdown with David Luiz, who he dumped at the start of the season. His defense got to 54 goals, the worst defensive record. Was it the worst defensive record of the Premier League era? It's certainly a good bit worse than last season when they conceded 39. But look, that's all to look forward to. And obviously Chelsea are still in the Champions League. You may have forgotten that. You may have thought they were knocked out of the Champions League. But no, it was only the first leg that they lost, 3-0 against Bayern. So there's still a chance there of the ultimate glory. We didn't mention relegation yet. So obviously Villa have stayed up. The interesting one here, I think, is actually Bournemouth. I mean, Watford, you know, you had Troy Deeney talking about, am I going to stay? Am I going to go? I'm not sure. The more interesting one is actually Eddie Howe, and what he's going to do. Like the dilemma that he now has. Like, this is a guy who's spent almost his entire life at this one club. And so it's not just a normal situation where you're like, oh, I'm a young manager. I'm trying to make my way in the game. It's like, I am like the Guy Roux of this club. I'm almost the guy who lives in the bell tower. You know what I mean? Like, I'm that much of an institution in this place, you know? And can I, like, is Eddie Howe reaching the point where, like, what do you do if you're Eddie Howe? Do you say, okay, it's time for me to spread my wings and to bust out and maybe, you know, to succeed Moisey at West Ham or something, or maybe wait for Carlo Ancelotti to leave Everton, or, you know, maybe I could take over at Aston Villa when they sacked Dean Smith. You know, do I do that? Or do I say, I've given 25 years of my life to this club. Here's to the next 25 years. And risk then being maybe sacked by your Russian owner, around Christmas next year when things go belly up in the championship.
It does depend on the options. What do you do? Don't they? I mean, some of those options, I guess, might be more appealing than others. Do you remember what Owen Coyle? Was that the name of that manager?
Owen Coyle, Bournemouth. Bolton.
Had been with Burnley, and he left Burnley to go to Bolton, who were in and around the same. And I remember thinking, that's a bit underwhelming to be seen as a traitor by one club, only to move to Bolton. At the time, they would have been seen as a bigger club, not anymore, but seen as a bigger club than Burnley with more money and resources and all that kind of stuff. So I'm saying is, if Eddie Howe just moves from Bournemouth to somebody a small level above, you're thinking, what's the point? But if something opens up, something closer to a dream move, then I don't think the Bournemouth fans can exactly begrudge him taking it.
But what constitutes a dream move? Like Tottenham? Like, you know, someone eventually says to Jose, listen, this is ridiculous, you know, you've got to go. And, you know, Jose was saying, when I came in, we were 14th and now we're 6th. It's been a pretty good season. And then you look back to those preseason predictions and you're like, hang on, everyone expected Tottenham to challenge for the title. And, you know, you're sixth, and you're telling us you've done a tremendous job. No, you can't. It is very true. I mean, in fairness, he did walk into a collapsing.
I'm not going to sit here and let you talk about Jose.
I don't want to be unfair to him, but you know the way.
In answer to your question, though, yes, that would be it. If I was Eddie Howe, I would probably take the Tottenham job. Everton.
There's a few jobs between Bournemouth and Tottenham. You're talking about Everton. Eddie Howe would look at it as a dream job.
That might be something more realistic. But why would Ancelotti leave, having only just taken the job this season? And on paper,
what about Burnley? I mean, Burnley, they're
top, you know, 10 finish again.
Well, look, all I'm saying is that they finished 10th. They've got a better defensive record than Bournemouth. Yes, it's true to say. Has Eddie Howe spent too long frolicking in the sunshine and the south coast? Might the sort of the lonely northern mists suit him for a while, or would he be a bit of a fish out of water?
I don't know how much frolicking he does. I think he might be a bit of a workaholic, old young Eddie.
I think young Eddie needs. I think his best bet would be to get a good season in the Championship with Bournemouth. So everyone isn't thinking, oh, Eddie Howe, yeah, he's that guy who kind of had that team that just stagnated and went nowhere, and he signed all these players like Solanke and Ibe and wasted all the money and they just fell apart, and then they were really boring and conceded 5 goals in every game and got relegated sort of without a whimper. You know, that's a bad, we're going back to the Jonathan Wilson point, you know, which is the real Leicester City, which is the real Eddie Howe. But like when that's the impression that's freshest in people's minds, it's never the best jumping off point, I think, for the next job. He'd be better off. And the thing is that he's the kind of manager whose success has been based on, you know, finding players that no one else was really, you know, that excited about, and working with those players and sort of unleashing the giant within those players. And it's a lot easier to do that in the Championship than it is in the Premier League, where those types of, you know, if you're a developmental manager whose idea of a really big signing is like, oh, I'm going to bet the house on Dominic Solanke. Yeah. Then, you know, it's very difficult when it's difficult to manage that way in the Premier League, where you've got like every week you're playing against teams that have £40 million players, and you know, it's so. Whereas maybe in the Championship, he has the opportunity to get a bit of the magic back.
We've got that bit better quality. We've just got to make it count. It might be a knob end. Is it too much to ask? In 91st minute, that wins it.
So basically, like, any chance you train? I think I really said something under his breath about Johnny or something.
You're always on the team until never.
Roy is Roy, isn't he? I'm sure there's lessons to be learned by everybody.
And Harry just gone, Roy, I'm not speaking to you like this. Like, you know, I'm not listening to you.
When I got the sack at Sheffield United, the only guy that spoke to me was Roy Keane. I'll never forget that. And I thought that was a bit of class. We've got that bit better quality, and we've just got to make it count.
He called me.
It might be a knob end in 91st minute that wins it.
Jacob Steinberg and Jack Pitbrook are with us at the end of the season. It felt like it might never end, but we got there in the end, lads. Thanks very much for talking to us. Obviously, a lot of different storylines coming out of the final weekend. Jacob, you've obviously been covering Chelsea. We might talk about them because it was a you could tell Lampard was bloody relieved. It was a fraught enough week for them. They conceded five at Anfield. There was the row with Klopp, and there was kind of a lot going on there. But I guess now all's well that ends well. He's still claiming that nobody expected him to get to that, they overachieved and people weren't expecting him to qualify for the Champions League. I don't know if that's true, but I suppose they're there now, so that's all he can do.
Yeah, I think that if you go back to last summer, I think that he's right that a lot of people weren't expecting Chelsea to be in the top four. I just saw before we went on someone on Twitter posting up a screenshot of various pundits, former players, and their top four predictions for the season at the start of the season, and I don't think many of them had Chelsea in the top four. I think a lot of them had Tottenham finishing in the top four, which kind of shows you where people's kind of mindset was at that time. I mean, Chelsea at that point, they weren't obviously able to sign anybody because of the transfer embargo. Eden Hazard going off to Real Madrid, not being able to replace him. A young manager coming in with no real experience. It meant that there was a lot of uncertainty over what we were really expecting from Chelsea at the start of the season. And I think that it's fair to point out that this probably is the weakest squad of the Roman Abramovich era. There are quite a few positions where you could identify flaws, weaknesses that probably meant that you thought that Chelsea weren't going to be able to do this. And the fact that they were bringing in so many inexperienced young players who hadn't played at this level before again meant you weren't sure what to expect. So I think it's fair for Lampard to look back at that point last summer and say that the expectations were low. I think that, however, as the season's gone on and they've got themselves into that position of being in the top four, which, you know, they've been there since I think October, and if they'd lost it on the final day, having wasted so many opportunities to get there over the last couple of months before lockdown came, obviously they had a few disappointing results at home, and then since the resumption of the season, the defeat at West Ham, which was, if they hadn't had that one breakaway goal, they would have already been there before they played Wolves at Stamford Bridge yesterday. The defeat at Sheffield United showed up the flaws within the squad. So I think he would have been under a lot of pressure if, from that position, they had managed to blow it. But in the end, they've got there. So you can say that it's a job well done for him.
Jack, what do you think?
Every time I think that... I haven't seen that much of Chelsea this year. Every time I think they're bad, they put a result out of the bag. Like those two wins against Tottenham, both of those times I went into the game expecting Tottenham to beat them. So clearly Lampard has got a way of getting results in individual big games. The fact they got 66 points over the course of the season, the same as Manchester United, I don't think that's an especially impressive total. And if I were Wolves or Spurs or Arsenal, I would probably still think that Chelsea and Man United were there for the taking next season. Obviously, Chelsea are going to be much better next year because they're going to have better players, but I do wonder whether or not they will have the right kind of stability and consistency to really elevate themselves beyond where they are at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting issue that you bring up, Jack. I mean, how things are going to be next season. What do you make of this, Jacob? I mean, what's the sense that you get? We all saw Timo Werner there wearing his mask incorrectly, which I was surprised by, I must admit. I thought that he'd be on point with the mask, but it was a shambles. We saw Mason Mount score a great free kick, which means that now they can replace him with Kai Havertz. Would Mason Mount have been better off scoring that goal at the other end and keeping Chelsea out of the Champions League so that people like himself and Tammy Abraham had a chance to grow? Is Chelsea just going to be a superstar dream team next year with, you know, they've already got Pulisic, obviously, and Ziyech. Werner has come in. And a lot of talk about Kai Havertz, which would seem like a lot of big signings for Chelsea in one sort of close season. Pulisic, not quite this part of this season, I guess. But, I mean, you know, do you think that Mason Mount and Tammy Abraham have a future here? You know, why are Chelsea so confident when everybody else is being a little bit cautious about how much they can spend with COVID-19?
Well, I think that Mason Mount is probably if you go through those youngsters, he's probably the one who's had the best seasons out of any of those youngsters at Chelsea. And he's probably the one who's nailed on to make it. I think 7 goals, 5 assists in his first Premier League season is a pretty good return. He's obviously had ups and downs because he's a young player who's playing for the first time at this level. So I think he's definitely somebody who's gonna have a big future at Chelsea. I think that Lampard always turns to him. There have been points where he's had a couple of moments since the restart where he's been taken off at half time in the Leicester Cup game, the Sheffield United defeat, but then he's always straight back into the team. As for Kai Havertz, I'd expect him to be potentially coming this week or the next couple of weeks. They're off to Germany soon to play the Bayern game, so perhaps that's going to be a point where they could meet up with Leverkusen and thrash out that deal. I think the worry for Chelsea is that obviously they've got these attacking players coming in with one more to probably follow, but it's at the other end where you worry about them. You know, 54 goals conceded in 38 league games, way more than anybody else in the top half. I think probably more in the end than Brighton. And it's the most that they've conceded since 96-97. So there are huge concerns there. I think you could look at individual failings in that back four or at times the back three and suggest that certain players probably aren't up to it. I think the goalkeeper, Kepa, certainly isn't up to it, and dropping him yesterday was a huge call from Lampard and one which paid off ultimately. But you wouldn't want to be going into next season with Willy Caballero as your first choice goalkeeper. So it's really going to be how they balance that out and whether or not they can find that stability at the back that's going to mean that they aren't just sort of looking to win games, you know, 5-3, 6-4 next season. You know, they're not going to get close to Liverpool or Manchester City if they're defending the way they did against Liverpool at Anfield last week. It's going to be very tough, and you would make them vulnerable again for their place in the top four, despite the attacking strengths. And I think that when it comes down to how much they have to spend, obviously they didn't do anything last summer because of the transfer embargo. They couldn't do anything in January because of many of the targets were out of reach, and Lampard was pretty frustrated at that point. They haven't spent big that in the last couple of years, so they do have that they do have the money left over. But when it comes down to whether or not they can replace the goalkeeper for when you're talking about potentially 100 million on Jan Oblak and potentially 70 million for a new left back in Ben Chilwell, something like that, and they need as well to get a top centre back, and that could be big money again. You worry about how much they've put into the attacking department and whether they're going to have enough funds left over to strengthen the defence, which I think ultimately is where it could be Lampard's undoing.
Well, they got to sell a lot of players, surely. I mean, you know, if you're talking about Mason Mount getting in this team, then it's goodbye to Kovacic, it's goodbye to Kante, Ross Barkley. I mean,
Kovacic has had a great season. I think the one who's probably the most vulnerable.
But we're talking about in a context where Kai Havertz is expected to come in, like he is going to be in the team. Now you can only see him playing in the team as an attacking midfielder or as, you know, a false nine. You could see how they might have a fairly tasty. You know, you could have Havertz as a false nine. You've got players like Pulisic and you've got Werner. You know, you could see how that could really work as a front three. I mean, obviously, it's goodbye to Tammy Abraham. You know, there's like, you know, Ziyech is going to have to wait to, you know, and see if he can make substitute appearances off the bench. But I mean, if we're looking at ways to generate money to improve the defense, there's got to be some players on the way out here. Who do you expect it to be?
Well, I think obviously you've got Pedro, and who's played his last game, well, definitely his last Premier League game. Lampard was keen to point out yesterday that he may well get 5 minutes off the bench in the cup final. Who's off to Roma on a free transfer? Willian, who is out of contract and is unlikely to get the 3-year deal that he wants, and may well end up at Arsenal, which I think would be a pretty bad signing for Arsenal. And there are probably players like Ross Barkley who could potentially fetch a big fee if they can find somebody who wants him and is able to pay his wages, and if they can convince Barkley to go. Jorginho with Sarri at Juventus is, you know, if they can make room for one more creative midfielder in that squad, then potentially they could get some of the feedback that they paid for Jorginho as well, who hasn't really convinced under Lampard this season, has been in and out of the side since the restart. Batshuayi, if they could find any way to get him off the books, he's got 1 year left and is on big money and is completely out of favour. And can they do anything with Kepa, who is on big wages, a long contract, and the most expensive goalkeeper in the world? Clearly Lampard doesn't rate him, doesn't trust him. If there's any way that they could get some kind of money for him or some kind of loan, then I suppose you're freeing up a bit more of the budget. But you're right that it's going to be difficult, especially in this this climate where some clubs aren't going to want to spend the kind of money that Chelsea want. And Chelsea have made a lot of expensive mistakes down the years and will kind of want clubs to sort of help them out with that. I think if you look at Barkley and Batshuayi potentially being offered in exchange for Declan Rice at West Ham, you're just asking West Ham really to deal with two of the messes that you've made for yourself, and they're not interested in it. It is going to be difficult for Chelsea to shift some of those players, and even someone like Kante, who in previous years they might have been able to look at a PSG or a Real Madrid and say, you know, do you want this guy? But are they going to be able to pay the fee that Chelsea would want for a player who's been in and out of the side and, you know, potentially is going to miss the cup final with another hamstring injury?
Jack, I would like to read a line out for you from Ken Early's column in the Irish Times today, if you don't mind. Frankly, it's bordering on insanity to claim that David Silva is better than his teammate Kevin De Bruyne, who's contributed 2 goals or assists every 3 league games during his City career, compared to Silva's 1 goal or assist every 2. A fairer question would be whether David or Bernardo is the best Silva at City. Now, I read that line and thought, he's having a pop at me here, is Ken. But now I read your tweets and I realise, no, this is a message aimed directly at you, Jack Pitbrook, who claimed on Twitter yesterday, game of opinions, etc. But for me, there's no question David Silva is the best and most important player in Manchester City's history. State your case for the defence, please.
I think Ken is right in the sense that De Bruyne has been better than Silva for the last few years. Don't think anybody, even I, wouldn't claim otherwise. Silva, more than any other player, has elevated the level of the City team over the course of the last 10 years. He's turned, you know, what usually when clubs, or often when clubs buy lots of very expensive players with no real plan about how to use them, they look a bit disjointed. And at times City have looked disjointed, but I think most of the moments of unity and success that the team have had over the years have been because they have a genuine football genius on the pitch who is able to bring players together and make things work and set the tempo and set the tone for the rest of the side. And that, more than anything else, has been Silva's great triumph. And I know that, you know, he doesn't score as many goals as De Bruyne or maybe get as many assists, but there is obviously a way of being influential on the pitch that, as a midfielder, which means you don't have to do that. Like, look at Modric, look at Eriksen, and players of that type. And I think City, you can tell how, again, like a kind of Modric or Eriksen type player, you can tell how valuable Silva is, because when he's not playing for City, it looks like the rest of the team have been lobotomised. Like, that's not quite so true now because of De Bruyne, but certainly in the past, if you took Silva out, the rest of the City players look clueless. Like, they've got no direction, no togetherness, no sense of what they're doing. So it's really that kind of the way that he used his intelligence to turn these players into a team that I think has really been Silva's triumph. And I think, and I can't really imagine any of the successes of the last 10 years without him.
Well, I can. I mean, if they didn't have him, they'd just have someone else. And it might have been someone better. They might have had Luka Modric. I mean, you talk about Luka Modric, he moved to Real Madrid and they immediately started winning the Champions League every season. Like, David Silva has been at Manchester City 10 years. They've won 4 league titles in that time, which to me seems like they probably should have won more. I mean, when you consider everything that's gone on, you know, Manchester United have been, you know, bad for 7 years. Liverpool were shambles for at least half of those seasons. Chelsea have had a couple of meltdowns. Leicester City won the league on David Silva's watch. They haven't won the Champions League. I mean, I find myself in this position always, like, it sounds like I'm attacking Silva and saying David Silva is no good. And that's not what I'm saying. I think David Silva is a very good player. I just don't understand why people routinely speak about him as being the best ever player. It's just, I'm kind of tearing my hair out. But I'm asking you, Jack, to regard me not as some kind of a troll who's just trying to have a pop, or just, you know, some little hustler who's trying to make a name for himself by, like, flinging, like the guy who threw his shoes at George Bush, right? Like, at that time. Like, that's not what I'm about here. Think of me instead as a soul in pain. Like a blind soul stumbling in the darkness, groping around for the truth. I just can't see what it is that makes David Silva so amazing compared to all these other amazing players, many of whom he's played with at Manchester City, that people continually elevate him to a status. I just feel he doesn't quite justify it. Okay. So I'm asking you to open my eyes, to let the scales fall from my eyes. Explain what it is that he's doing that's so amazing that I've been wrong about him all this time.
Yeah, well, I know you say you're not trolling, but I do nevertheless feel quite triggered by this and your piece in the Irish Times. Look, it's to do with control of the game, ultimately. It's to do with the way that he can take possession in what Pep calls the small spaces, the way that he can always keep City on the front foot. It's his work off the ball, which I think has slightly dimmed a bit in the last few years as his kind of ankles have got tired. The way that he keeps the pressure on the opposition, the fact, you know, he can play a brilliant pass inside a fullback onto Leroy Sané, who's running in behind. If City are trying to keep control of the game and dominate possession to see out a win, he can do that too. He can play this kind of long passes, short passes. He's got the kind of complete mastery of everything he wants to do with the ball. And because of his intelligence on the pitch and that awareness of where everyone is at every given instant, he can kind of organise the whole team around himself. I just think he's a kind of glue for that team. And I think he also, I mean, there was a slightly ridiculous tweet going around yesterday about his calmness and professionalism. And calmness is kind of a strange word to use, but he does, I do think he has a kind of soothing effect on the rest of the City team at times. And he's also very good to watch. Like, he's also, I feel that kind of smooth intelligence that he has transmits itself to both the player, his teammates, and to the fans.
Well, I'm convinced. I know Ken is convinced, judging by the fact he hasn't come back in there. Finally, his eyes have been opened. What about yourself, Jacob?
I think it gets a little bit ridiculous when you hear Pep saying stuff like he's the best player in the small spaces, and you are kind of thinking, you managed Leo Messi and Xavi and Iniesta. So come on, you're probably being a little bit overblown there. And then I saw that Arteta said the same thing as well. So maybe it's just a thing that people who've coached Silva decide that, you know, that's the reality for the rest of us, and we should just accept it. But I don't know. I think when we talk about the best foreign player ever to play in the Premier League, then you've got to take in people like Ronaldo, Suarez, Thierry Henry, Bergkamp. I don't think that Silva's close to being on that level. I think that there have been times as well where he's probably had dips which have been quite important for City. And I think that even when they won the league in the 2011-12 season, I think he sort of faded quite badly by his own standards in the second half of the season, which was partly why they almost ended up losing it to Manchester United. So, yeah, I think that he's an absolutely fantastic player, but a little bit overrated by some.
I think it's unfair to use Guardiola's insincerity against David Silva. It's not Silva's fault.
What I was going to say, actually, just a quick one to both of you, just to wrap up on the Silva. Do you think it is an indictment of English football that Jordan Henderson can become Footballer of the Year and David Silva never has? Or is it just an indictment of England's corrupt media class?
I don't think it's that bad. Like, I didn't vote for Henderson. I voted for De Bruyne. And I don't think, I nearly voted for Sadio Mane. I had probably have Henderson as, like, my number three pick from Liverpool. But I don't think it's illegitimate to have someone who is, you know, given that the award is meant to include off the field behaviour, setting the right standards, that sort of thing, I think it is fine for Henderson to win it. He's obviously, he's played really well this year. He's a really good captain. He's a great speaker away from the game. The NHS stuff. I don't think he's an illegitimate choice.
I don't know. I think that if you go back to what was it around midway of last season, where people were just expecting Fabinho to take Henderson's place, and that would be it for Henderson at Liverpool. And actually, what's happened with Fabinho is that he's allowed Henderson to become a more and better player, more effective player in the down that inside right channel for Liverpool and in that number eight role. I think that if he was as overrated now as some people are trying to put out there, then I don't think he would be in a Jurgen Klopp team. I think that Klopp isn't just picking him because he's a good captain. I think he's picking him because he's a very good player who's progressed a lot in the last year or so. Perhaps there might have been a bit of a backlash if there'd been a Euros this summer and we'd seen Henderson maybe struggling a little bit against a France or a Germany as he did in that Croatia semi-final where he just kept giving the ball away. But I think, you know, I don't really hold too many grudges against him for winning this award, even though I would have personally liked to see Trent Alexander-Arnold win it for kind of redefining the right back role as he set out to do at the start of the season.
Jack, you have got a big piece today on Daniel Levy, gone up on The Athletic. I feel like I almost went. Well, I feel like I know more about Daniel Levy than the people who went to college with him, who apparently don't know anything about him. Now, barely anyone can remember him from his college because he was such a bookworm, and he wanted to get a first because he thought that was the best way to get a good job. Even though his actual career took the form of making friends with a billionaire and running a company on behalf of that billionaire. So, you know, it was very interesting stuff, but you are kind of basically putting forward a couple of kind of big conclusions here. One of them is that, you know, Tottenham Hotspur are in great shape. They are compared to when Levy took over, they were worth 80 million and now they're worth about 2 billion. And you've almost got, when you even just thinking about that fact, we're worth 80, now worth 2 billion. The question arises, is it time to cash in the chips?
Well, I think that if, were it not for the coronavirus pandemic, I think it would be quite likely that Spurs would be sold at some point soon. I now don't think, I think there are not many buyers for £2 billion assets around for a while. Whether or not he should cash in the chips, well, I think, you know, it would be great for Levy and Lewis on a financial level. That's Joe Lewis, the owner, Levy's boss, if they were to sell the club. But I don't think, even if they were to cash in the chips, Levy doesn't want to go anywhere. He wants to stay on and run the club as a CEO for the next few years, even if they're sold. So I don't think there's much prospect, if you're a Spurs fan, hoping that you're going to get bought by a kind of Abramovich, Abu Dhabi type figure. I don't think that's going to happen. I suppose the best you can hope for is somebody in either buys or buys an equity stake and someone who's willing to turn the taps on a little bit more when it comes to transfer spending.
Yeah. I mean, it's not known for very rich people to spend lots of money in a recession, but usually not at the kind of premium prices that Daniel Levy likes to sell things at, is part of that deal. I mean, the question does arise, and this is something I think your article is sort of trying to get to grips with, certainly towards the end, but how bad has this... has this sort of stadium closure or corona crisis been for Tottenham? I mean, it seems as though they're probably the worst affected club, given, you know, on the face of it, they're the ones who just opened the most expensive stadium in the country, which they now cannot use. Although it turns out they have been using it. And this was something I found quite interesting. It's not as though that stadium has just been sitting there empty. It's actually been pretty busy. Providing a venue for maternity services and various NHS functions and things like this. Now I wondered, has that softened the blow quite considerably for Tottenham? I mean, it was certainly the case in this country that some hotels and things like this, or certainly some private hospitals, places which might have been expected to be hit by the restrictions, ended up
signing government contracts, which let's say tided them over pretty well through the tough period. And I just wondered if maybe Tottenham have found an unexpected way out of the real financial crunch that was coming with this thing by doing deals with the government of that nature.
I genuinely don't know what the financial agreement was between the NHS and Tottenham, or North Middlesex Hospital, who've been using the stadium's resources. Tottenham estimate that the closure would have cost them about £200 million because the stadium was meant to be a way to print money, basically. You know, there's incredible VIP and hospitality resources there. They were expecting that their matchday revenue would go through the roof because of how much money they can make, particularly from these, you know, I mean, all the seats are expensive, but particularly from the most expensive seats in the ground. And on top of that, it was going to be, you know, somewhere that could rival the London Stadium in terms of non-football events. So this summer they were meant to have Lady Gaga, Guns N' Roses, Anthony Joshua fight, rugby league, rugby union, NFL. And of course, with the kind of golden egg being the prospect of an NFL franchise based in Tottenham, which would make them a huge amount of money. So the fact that all of this stuff, which they would have banked on, as you would, has been turned off for, you know, well, probably more or less until there's a vaccine, has massively hit their revenue. And I'm sure that if they, you know, if none of this had happened, and Spurs had been hosting all this massive money raising events this summer, then I'm sure they would have been much more attractive to buyers who would have recognised, you know, ownership of the club as a way to make tons of revenue to the stadium.
Jack, great stuff. People can read that piece on The Athletic. Jacob, thanks a million. Cheers for chatting.
Thank you.
It's like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
You go down Temple Bar, you see them coming out of pubs, vomiting, having sex on the side of the street.
It's like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
You know, is that the normal we want in this country? You know, we're supposed to be civilised. As far as I can see, this country is getting more barbaric.
Well, I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
What would you see in a porno movie, Mary?
A little reminder that we have a big one coming up for you tomorrow on the World Service. Rachel Den Hollander, Larry Nassar abuse survivor. She's also a lawyer, an advocate for victims of sexual abuse, and just a massively impressive person. Can't wait to put that one out for you tomorrow. As for last week, we had a great chat with David Walsh about the Russian anti-doping whistleblowers, Vitaly and Yulia Stepanov. Vitaly's motivation for blowing the whistle was clear. He was on something of an anti-doping crusade for a few years. But Yulia, she was a top athlete, a doper herself, wife to Vitaly. But so why did she decide to take down the Russian system, uproot her life, knowing that she can never come back home, become a hate figure among her peers? She must have really drilled down logically into the pros and cons before deciding to join her husband on this insane adventure, right? No, faith healer. That's the answer, faith healer.
And the woman said, what do you want from life? And Yulia said, well, I am a professional athlete and I want to be as good as I can be. And the woman said to her, don't concentrate on running. It will frustrate you. It's not what you need. What you need is because what I see in your life is I see a good man reaching his hand out to you. And you will eventually take that man's hand and he will be right for you. And with whom you will have two kids and you will have a good life. You will continue running, but it won't bring you happiness. And Yulia thought, this woman, you know, would have made me happy if she told me about what a great runner I was going to be. And because the woman told her what Yulia did not want to hear, Yulia believed her. And when Yulia, all these years later, she's in the Crimea and she's told by Vladimir Kazarin, who's her new coach, she's going to get a ban for, as you've said, the athlete biological passport transgressions. And Yulia is stuck there because she's booked in for 2 weeks. So she gets this knowledge maybe on Tuesday or Wednesday, and she's got 3 days to think about it before she goes back. And she now knows she's not going to be able to run for 2 years. She's already signed up for the divorce with Vitaly. And Yulia thinks, all the men I've been involved with in my life have basically screwed me. They wanted me to be a top athlete. They gave me drugs to do that. They wanted a relationship with me. I went with that. But they really weren't there for me. They were using me. And it became clear to her that the one guy who actually didn't want something from her, only wanted to give her love, she'd kind of been indifferent to him and kind of rejected him. And it struck her that she'd been a complete idiot and that she got everything wrong.
Murph, Ken, ever make such serious life decisions based on the premonition of a faith healer somewhere in Russia or elsewhere?
I've never been to one.
No, yeah. Tarot cards for me.
Have you been?
No, no, just have me own. I've just assigned my own methodology to a set of tarot cards.
So what if it,
and, it's worked
like
out pretty good
I
for
can
me.
Just imagine, like the tarot person or whatever is there, just the first card is death.
Yeah, that's good.
Again, death.
Oh, that's even better.
Third card is the jester. The fourth card is again death.
That's good, right?
I don't know. I mean, do they even have more than... They probably don't have more than one card in each...
And yet, still three death cards come up. You'd have to say that's a bad sign. That is definitely a bad sign.
I thought the point with those things, though... I mean, it was interesting what David Walsh was saying there. Like, or it... Well, maybe it's just the sort of obstinacy of Yulia that, like... I thought their whole sort of shtick was like, what does this person want me to tell them?
You know,
and then tell them that, like try and figure that out and tell them that rather than...
In this case, being very cynical about her running career. It's like, you're not going to...
You'll get nowhere with that.
find a good man. That would seem to be the advice there. All right, that's it for today, guys. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken. But great to have the two of you back. You were... on breaks at various stages of last week.
Great to be back on.
Great to be back.
It was bad. You know how it happened. Like, I don't know if you... Did you explain how that happened?
What?
How we both ended up being away at the same time.
Well, no. It's too inside baseball.
It's actually quite funny. Owen sent an email saying, I was thinking of taking this week off. To which Kieran immediately replies, about that. Actually, I've already booked that week off. And to which I then replied saying... you'll never believe this, but I've actually booked that week off as well. To which Mark then replied saying, you'll never believe this. Maybe this isn't the best time to mention that I also have booked that week off.
Without actually informing any of their colleagues, dear listeners.
You were the only one who had mentioned it, Owen. You were the only one.
And I was the one who couldn't go away on my week off.
As a result, you hadn't already booked it. That's not the way to run a company.
Let's just say I've learned some lessons, Murph and Ken. I've learned some lessons. I'm not even telling our listeners. The next time you find out that I'm off on a week is when you try and join this Zoom chat and I'm just not here.
It's just not there.
I've actually gone for a month. I've gone for a sabbatical.
You're a bloody great work colleague. I've missed you like crazy.
Everyone was just reaching the end of their tethers around the same time, which I guess must have included you too, Owen. So well done on last week.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Owen. Sorry again about the...
whatever.
You know.
The unpleasant.
Sorry about that.
See you tomorrow.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.